But Richard Mao, he is the president of Fuller Theological Seminary, and Neil Clark Warren is the founder of eHarmony. And we're going to invite these two gentlemen to come up on stage and join us for our discussion. So the format for tonight's time together, we've asked each of our speakers to speak for about 15 minutes, some prepared questions that they're going to be answering or addressing. And then after that, I'm going to ask a few questions. And then during the time when I'm asking questions, we actually want each table to come up with a question that you would like to ask one of these two gentlemen. So during the time when I begin the Q&A, you guys will have an opportunity to discuss what question would you like to ask? And we'll have some people who will be collecting these questions from each table. So without further ado, I think, Richard, can you start us off with your remarks?
Yeah, I'm going to take most of the time because I know they're far more interested in what a seminary president has to say than a psychologist who talks about singleness and marriage. So. No, it's great to be here. And one of the things I was asked to start off with, and then really make the connection to the larger topic of the evening, is a recent study that we did, conducted by myself and Andy Crouch from Christianity Today. And I want to say funded by Bill Wang, who is a trustee at Fuller Seminary. And over a couple of years, we worked on a project called the Seminary of the Future. And we met with groups of 15 or 20 people, various categories. Spent a whole day with a group of about 25 African-American pastors from all over the continent and also all over the ecclesiastical map. We met with Latino pastors. We met with quite a few people in Hollywood, some of whom who are studying at Fuller. People who are studying theology and working for MTV, studying theology and reading scripts at Disney as a career, and a number of other groups. But one was we met with some of you, about 20 folks here from both the arts community and the financial services community, and basically asked the question, what do you wish a seminary would be doing that would empower and enable and just equip you for your callings in the world? And those were wonderful discussions. We learned a lot. And concluded, let me just mention three of the major conclusions. One is that seminaries need to do a lot more by way of connecting what we call core and edge. You know, at the heart of theological education, we study theology. We study the Bible. We study church history. But it's so important to connect that, not just with the practices of church ministry, which are very important, how to preach, how to administer, how to counsel, but also what is church history? What is the Bible? What does systematic theology have to say to hedge funds? What does it have to say to Metropolitan Opera? What does it have to say to people in the world of the arts, the visual arts? What does it have to say to Hollywood? And we heard a lot of folks saying they want to make those connections. And we've been working at that at Fuller Seminary and obviously a number of other people in other seminaries as well. We had a New Testament professor who, just before he died very suddenly, said to me, you know, when I first started teaching at Fuller, the New Testament and the writings of St. Paul, I thought, and this is very relevant to this evening, he said, I thought the most important question that anybody could deal with in studying Galatians is when was it written, the dating of Galatians. He said, you know, lately I've been thinking dating among the Galatians is a much more important question. And if you read the later chapters in Galatians about the sins of the flesh and the sins of the spirit and all those kinds of things, that makes a lot of sense. And so one of the questions we have to be asking is, what is the Bible have to say about the patterns of our daily lives? And so vocation, the serious study of culture, not just indoctrinating people, not just some kinds of indoctrination and the like, but rather the serious study of culture, really wrestling. And this is one of the wonderful things about my good friend and colleague here on the platform with me, Neil Clark Warren, is that as a psychologist who's also grounded in and has studied theology, to really study the culture of singleness, of marriage, of the whole courtship and kinship system in our culture, and to do that with Christian discernment and Christian sensitivities. And so those are very important issues. And with the Faith and Works Center, I'm so glad that David and Catherine and others have been so eager to have this kind of discussion this evening. Because, you know, in many ways, as we have developed, and those of you who have been Gotham Fellows or been at some of the wonderful conferences and workshops that have been put on by the Faith and Work people here and by Tim himself, you'll know that we talk a lot about vocation, about calling. And we ground that in Genesis 1, you know, that God creates the man and the woman, and the first thing he says to them, have dominion, you know. And that we're not here just to lie around in the garden enjoying ourselves, but we're here to take care of the creation and working in banking, working in investment, working in the grocery business, working in as psychologists. All of these things are ways of serving in God's creation. God cares about our work. God calls us to be doing the kinds of things that that we discern we ought to be doing, giving our God-given talents and interests and all of that. And then we go from Genesis 1 to Genesis 3. Oh, but it all got screwed up because of sin, you know, and now, you know, investment goes bad and politics goes bad and sexuality goes bad and all the rest. And so we need to look at the brokenness and the distortedness of the creation. We need to look behind that into the original creating purposes of God. You know, we often don't spend much time on Genesis 2. You know, God takes that man and that woman in Genesis 1 and says, have dominion over the earth and do it together, men and women together. But in Genesis 2, we get a kind of slow motion replay of Genesis 1. And what Genesis 2 is saying is, and let's go back and look at this in detail. Here's what happened. That God didn't exactly create them both at the same time, but he created the man first. And he looked at the man and he said, oh, not enough yet. It's not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper fit for him. And the word helper there is really the same word that later on gets used for God. The Lord is my helper. I mean, this is not inferiority, but it's two equal human beings. And then God decides to, at that point, God tells Adam to name the animals. And, you know, as I was growing up, I thought that the naming of the animals was the first exercise in detached scientific taxonomy. You know? The parade of the animals goes before Adam. And he says, call that one an elephant. Call that one a chipmunk. Call that one a beetle. Call that one a hawk. You know? And all the animals they parade in front of him. But it wasn't a dispassionate, detached activity. Because at the end of it, it says, and there was not found a helper fit for him. You know what it's like? It was like spending the whole day when you wish you had a date and you spent the whole day alone in the Bronx Zoo, you know? And at that point, the Lord God puts him to sleep. And then I think what the Lord really said is, you know, just in case anybody is ever even tempted to think that she's inferior to him, I'm going to use exactly the same stuff. In fact, I think I'll take it right out of her. And he creates the woman. And Adam wakes up. And one of the wonderful modern translations put this way. He sees Eve and he says, at last. You know, after that motley, flea-bitten, parade of the animals. At last, flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone. Because God in Genesis 1 told them to have dominion, but in Genesis 2, he's making it clear that he wants to have them have dominion together in a kind of intimate relationship. But I want to warn you about one thing there. That's not just about marriage. Marriage is one of the ways in which we can say, at last. But another way is in friendship. Another way is in communities of people with common interests who get together. And it's that at last, flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone, that we need each other. God has created us for relationship, for community, so that we may exercise dominion together over the creation, but also just to be together. Because we can't properly exercise dominion unless we are together, unless we have that kind of covenantal relationship together. And so much of that has to do with cultivating relationships. And this is really what this kind of research that Neil Clark Warren has done, why it's so important for us, because we're really exploring, not just in marriage, but we're exploring in friendships and in various kinds of groups, vocational groups and study groups, and in so many other ways in the life of the church. We're studying ways in which we can be in the kind of community in which we come to know ourselves better before the face of the living God. And that means that life is more than work. It's more than about exercising dominion, although many of us have been saying, because it hasn't been said enough, it is about that. But it's not just about that. It's about the creation of community, the creation of relationships. And for many of us, but not all of us, it means the special intimacy of a marriage relationship. But as human beings coming together before the face of God and asking God, as the psalmist does in 139, Lord, search me and know me and see if there be any wicked way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. But there's also ways in which we need to say to each other, search me and know me and see if there be any wicked way in me. And friendship, in marriage, in small group discussions, groups of people with common interests have that kind of wonderfully. One of the Latin American theologians said that we got to be activists, but it's so important for us, in order to be effective activists, to waste time with God. Yeah? That prayer and worship are simply wasting time with God. That's so important. But God also wants us to waste time with each other. And just to be, to abide in the presence of each other before the face of God. And so that's really, I think, one of the reasons why we're here tonight, is just to talk about what that means with the serious study of culture. You know, Fuller Seminary was founded in 1947. And in 1965, after 18 years of a school of theology, the people in charge founded a school of psychology and a school of world mission. Today we call it the School of Intercultural Studies. And that study of the therapeutic culture and the study of the cultures of the nations of the earth and the cultures of different ethnic and racial groups is such an important part of what it means to prepare to bring good news to the world that God calls us to serve. And Neil Clark Warren was, for a number of years, the dean of our school of psychology. And a lot of people hated to see him go, but we're so pleased that when he went into clinical practice, and out of the kind of research that he did there, he was able to establish an organization, a company, a service to human beings, and that's based on the very careful study of the culture of gender, courtship, friendship, singleness, marriage, and I'm glad that I get to listen to them again tonight. Thanks.
Thank you, Rich. Pass it over to you, Neil.
Well, greetings to all of you. I have to tell you that it is very interesting for Marilyn and me to be here tonight, and we think this is probably the most exciting church in America. When I heard from David that at one point, at least, you had 5,000 people attending church, and you had about 3,000 singles, you don't usually find anything like that. I suspect that this is the only church that has... You guys are wonderfully devoted to your singleness, or... So the question about whether you're willing to go, you know, outside of New York, if you were to find love, I suppose you could narrow that down. Are you willing to go outside your house? But I must say that, you know, I love Fuller Seminary. I didn't go to Fuller Seminary. I went to Princeton Seminary. But I love Fuller Seminary just because you saw some of the spirit of Dr. Mao tonight. Dr. Mao and Dr. David Hubbard have been the presidents of Fuller Seminary for 50 years. 30 for one and 20 for another. It's incredible to have that kind of leadership. And when I read the books of your pastor, which, you know, have created a sensation across America, largely because, in my opinion, you have this church here that has obviously shone forth as a place where people find a wonderful opportunity to meet God. When you see that, you want to read from a person who has been central to that kind of development. So I'm very pleased to be here. Now, I have to tell you something. I found myself all through the early part of this discussion tonight thinking we need some disclaimers. Please know that we feel we're far more often failures at trying to help you than we're successful. At the very best, we think that 30% of the people who come to eHarmony end up getting matched with somebody that really makes sense for them. 15% of all the people who come to us do get married. We have about 542, on the average, 542 people a day who get married on eHarmony. And we have about 100,000 marriages a year. But that's, I mean, I have to tell you that many days we get 15 or 20,000 applicants. We never get less than 10,000 applicants in a given day. Many of you have been there. So I want to give you this disclaimer. We know that we haven't done a very good job yet. When you get 15%, I mean, so please don't think that we come here in any kind of cocky spirit. We don't have that at all. We are excited about the fact that a high number of people are finding someone with whom they can be genuinely happy. Do they find it easily or quickly? No. I told the people we were with, the Wongs and others today that... we couldn't believe that one man on our ads for eHarmony said that he had been matched with 500 women and that he had actually met 500 women. I don't know how long it took him to do that, but at any rate, he said that when he was eventually matched with this one woman, he knew immediately that she was the right person for him. Now, I don't know if that happens very often, but I asked the woman, I said, so how many matches have you had on eHarmony? And she said, this was the first one. Some of you know that feeling of not getting nearly as many matches as you would like to have. I'm here today to empathize with you. It's the hardest thing in the world. You know when Scott Peck started that book that was the largest selling book in the 80s? The Road Less Traveled. Highest selling book in America in the 80s. And he started out with that one sentence, life is difficult. I have to tell you, I think life really is difficult. This morning I got up at 5 o'clock because Richard Mao said that he always gets up at 5 o'clock. And so I thought, and about 7:30 I think he came out. And I knew.
4:30 California time.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Now he's into. Yeah. So anyway, I got up at 5 o'clock, and I was thinking about how difficult life is. And I was I was thinking about the fact that if you're like I am, sometimes it just gets you down. It's hard. about the time you think things are going fairly well, things start not going well at all. And I know what it's like to want something very, very much. Now, hey, listen, I know that there are many of you here tonight who are single and you don't want to be married. That's fine. I always say, if you can be happy and be single, stay single. I mean, it's a good life. And it's a much less difficult, rigorous life to just have one person to please rather than two. So you don't need to be, look at the New Testament leaders. Virtually every one of them, right, David, was single. That we know of. We're pretty sure the Apostle Paul was single. Jesus was single, unless there's some kind of crazy thing. I mean, it's some, you know, that we haven't been told about it.
He was single.
Don't
go there. Huh?
No, he's telling me now I'm treading on his territory. But and John the Baptist was single, and Peter was married, but most of them were single, and they had contented lives. So if you're single and you're happy, you're contented, that's wonderful. You don't need to get married. On the other hand, most people, it's only been a few years ago that 90% of all the people in America eventually got married. Now, what I want to say to you is that something awful has happened to marriage in our culture. And you know that. And I expected it, but I never knew it was going to be this profound. Between 1945 and 1985, the divorce rate in America went up 300%. 300%. What's the cause of that? I think it was because of the vast displacement of people during the Second World War. People moved all over the country, and they ended up oftentimes getting married in other parts of the country, away from extended family and all the security that extended family could give to them. But the other thing that happened is that when they moved away from the rural zones of America, in 1945, one out of every three persons in America was involved with a farm. By 1985, it was one out of 28 persons who were involved with a farm. I grew up in Iowa, so I know these big combines came in. And these combines could take the place of, I think, around 35 men, some of them. And so there wasn't room on the farm for all these workers. And so they moved to other parts of the country. That was a big problem. One of the other things that happened during that time was we started, because of the Second World War and all the devastation that took place in the Second World War, we started expecting a whole lot less out of life. And we gave up a lot of our spirituality. We gave up a lot of our traditions, a lot of our old-fashioned traditions that had been way more important than we knew. And we started trying to go it alone a lot. And that was a major problem. So you got this wildly rampaging divorce rate in our country. And I remember Dr. Hubbard, who was our president at that time in the place that Richard Mao now is, Dr. Hubbard used to say to me, keep them together, keep them together. It's important. They covenanted before God to stay together. And I can remember sitting in those counseling offices and listening to people's pain with one another and thinking, how in the world do you keep people together? I used to say to Marilyn, my wife, how many mismatches can you have in a relationship and still hold it together with willpower? If you really aren't right for each other and you just try to hold it together by grit and determination, how much grit and determination can you have? So it began to be clear to me as I investigated all these divorces. I saw hundreds. I saw 7,000 people in clinical practice over time. And I saw so many people going through the process of divorce. And it was never easy. It was always difficult. I never saw an easy divorce. I saw some that were wildly painful. I had people in my office who spat at one another. They were so hurt and so angry and so upset. They just couldn't believe. They weren't made for divorce. But
they began to see their marriage falling apart, and they saw the devastation to the children. I never saw children profit from divorce. I saw them profit maybe from getting apart for a season, but not divorce. So I started looking at all this and just really doing a careful analysis of it. And I came to the conclusion that a whole lot of people get married who shouldn't have. And you begin to look at what an incredible, an incredibly complex challenge it is to be a human being. And then you look at what an incredibly complex challenge it is for one human being to find another human being they want to pair up with. And they want to have everything in common for the rest of their days. Marilyn and I have been married for 53 years. And I have to tell you something. We've had such a blessed life. It's unbelievable to me how blessed our lives have been. But I will tell you, too, that we've gone through a lot of pain. And we've gone through a lot of suffering. Everybody does. I don't know anybody who doesn't. We've made a lot of mistakes along the way. I don't know anybody who doesn't. You tell me about a perfect marriage, and I want to see those people right away. I just don't think it happens very often. You've gone through a home where there was a marriage. You know your mom and your dad, or you know your mom and you didn't know your dad, or you know your dad and you didn't know your mom, or whatever it is, you had some people where you were born into that marriage. And some of you have been in marriages. 51 or 2% of all the people who come to eHarmony have been married before. Many, many people get married and they discover on their honeymoon, this is not the right relationship. It's almost like those guys on the road to Emmaus. Suddenly their eyes were open and they recognized him. I mean, they go off to Hawaii and they say, "Ooh, I married you. You're not." So sometimes people discover it too late. And we started thinking to ourselves, what in the world could we do? So here's what we did in a nutshell. We took 5,000 married couples and we said, we're going to really analyze these couples carefully. And we eventually got it down to 800 couples, 200 in a really satisfied group, 200 in a pretty satisfied group, 200 in not a satisfied group at all, and 200 in a horribly disappointing group. And we began to compare the outside groups, the wonderfully happy group and the very, very disappointed group. And we started looking for things that were statistically significant in differentiating these two groups. And we began to find these variables. And as they brought these variables into me, and we had some of the top statisticians in the country, really, who brought these variables in, these dimensions on which these two groups were significantly different. From my clinical experience, I started saying, yes, well, that's obvious. And yes, that's obvious, too. I didn't have a single one that I said, I don't get that one. You know, like, for instance, let me tell you about intelligence. You've got to marry somebody who's pretty close to your intelligence level. As a matter of fact, the statisticians found out that you need to find somebody who's within one standard deviation of your intelligence. That means that if you're 130, and by the way, some people think their intelligence is 140 or 150 or whatever. The Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale doesn't go that high. So if you have 130 IQ, which is three standard deviations above the mean, then you need somebody around 120 at least to as high as you can go. You need somebody within your ballpark, because if not, you're going to start talking conceptually to them and they're going to say, wait a second, I don't understand that. I don't like it when you talk like that. So you want somebody in your body. And then take for instance, energy. You've got to have about the same amount of energy, both psychic and physical energy, as the person you're around. I can't imagine anything worse than getting up on Saturday morning with a list of chores that need to be done, and the other person is still in bed. And they stay in bed till noon. And then they move from the bed to the couch. And they're watching television, and they're watching football and all that. It doesn't work. It doesn't feel right. So we began to look at these dimensions, and we found 29 of them. 29 dimensions that clearly differentiated these two groups. We said, wouldn't it be great if we could maybe make some progress in putting somebody together with somebody else for whom these 29 dimensions were matched? And people came to me and said, how many of them can you have mismatched? Because you know what I know. If you meet somebody who's wonderfully attractive to you and you've got a lot of chemistry going, you start trying to find ways to, you know, explain away the dimensions on which you're not matched. And they said, they would say to me, how many of these can I get along without? And I would say, I've never seen a great marriage that had more than five of the 29 mismatch. I just haven't. And they said, well, how many could we have survived on? And I said, well, I honestly believe I've never seen a marriage survive that had more than 10 of these 29 dimensions mismatch. Now, you know that there are some of them that are more important than others, but overall, you've got to be matched like that. Well, no, you go to marriage counselors in the country. I don't mean to put down any marriage counselors. You go to pastors in the country and you say, tell us what you think the 29 dimensions are on which you need to be matched in order to be really happy in a marriage. And most of them can't give you 15 of them. It is not broadly known what these dimensions are. I've talked too long. Yeah, no. No, you probably can't buy a book, as a matter of fact. But I don't want to belabor this. I just want to say, I think marriage is the greatest thing God ever invented. I just think it's so close to the relationship we have with Christ. And that Paul talks about that. And I think if you can get that right, it's the greatest thing on earth. If you have it wrong, it's the worst thing on earth. And unfortunately, too many people in our society have just had to go through the pain of having it wrong. If you've gone through the pain of somebody having it wrong that you love, you know what I mean. The pain of that is torturous. So, you know, I tell you something. You talk about the seminary of the future. Let's talk about the church of the future. There will come a time that we will be able to match up with each other in a way that will satisfy us for a lifetime, for eternity, is the way we like to think about it. I so much wish that we had a way to do it for you, because you're here tonight. You came out for this meeting, and I know you want to go home with some hope in your heart. Whatever it is you want, if you want to remain single, but you just want desperately to be content. You want to be happy. I want you to be able to go home tonight and say, I have a real desire to be content, and I think there's hope for me. And if you want to be married and you come here and you say, I would give almost anything to be married to the right person, I want you to be able to go home tonight and feel like there's really hope for you. I have to tell you something. If you stand where Marilyn and I stand, and you see 542 people averagely every day get married on eHarmony. It's 5% of all the marriages in America. And you sit there and you explore them the way we have. We've got pictures in our house of people who've got married on eHarmony. And it's very exciting. Marilyn, if she were up here, would be able to tell you more specifically how exciting it is for these people to talk about how blessed they feel to have found the right person. Do I think that it's just a matter of time until virtually everyone will be able to find that on our site? I do. Last thing I want to say, David, I know I've taken too long, but I want to say this. I've become more and more convinced that in order to get married right, you have to get right yourself. And if you try to get married before you're right yourself, in a right relationship with yourself, you will inevitably mess up your marriage. So, a long time ago, I didn't become a Christian until I was 40. But I got to tell you that a long time ago, I became aware of the fact that there's no way that you can really get to know yourself and get into a right relationship with yourself without getting into a right relationship with God. And honestly, I believe what the gospel is all about is, as a psychologist, I believe it's the most wonderful thing that ever happened when God said, you can't do it yourself. All your strategies will eventually fail you. You can only do it in one way, and that's if you let me do it for you. If you let me love you the way you need to be loved, then you'll be able to do it. So I come here tonight saying, you do that front end work. That front end work is opening yourself to that spirit that says, let me do it. Let me do something great for you. And then if you come out, I have to be careful what I say. Merrill always gets upset with me, but I promise you, I'll do everything in my power to personally help you find the right person. We have somebody on our staff, for instance, that if David came to me and you weren't married so beautifully, but if you wanted to be married and you came to me and you said, Neil, can you help me? I would say, let me introduce you to our associate, Joe Zink, who I promise you can do everything in his power to help you with our several million people to find the right person for you. And one of the things, by the way, that Joe Zink will do is to ask you to think about how much do you want to be married? If you want to be married a lot, then open up your geographical boundaries and be pretty careful with what you're demanding of people. Make sure that these are real needs of yours and become a little more flexible in the way you present yourself. And I think there's tremendous hope for you to find the right person.
Thank you. Having these two gentlemen upstage is like, for a pastor at least, it's like a kid in a candy store, because so many of the questions that I get asked as a pastor, it's about relationships. About 90% of the questions that pastors typically get asked are about relationships. So to have two seasoned, you guys are experts in this area, and I know you would be modest, but with all that you guys have seen from a psychological perspective, from a pastoral and theological perspective. So I just want you guys to think about what kind of questions, this is a real choice opportunity that we all have. What kind of questions would you like to ask? Start thinking about that. I'm going to prime the pump a little bit and start with a few questions, but I just want to encourage you guys to start thinking about what would be some of the questions you would want to ask these two gentlemen. One of the questions I have is, growing up in the church, you often hear the most important thing about a marriage is their faith in Christ. And as you get older, the advice changes. That's the only thing you really need. You could pretty much marry anyone who has faith in Christ, as long as it's a sincere faith. How would you respond to that from a pastoral, a seminarian, a theologian who trains pastors, as well as from a psychological perspective?
You start. Go ahead.
Well, I don't believe that. Let me tell you, I think it's the most important thing of all. But just like I was saying, you know, you have to have spiritual compatibility, but you better have intellectual compatibility. If you don't have intellectual compatibility, you better have a whole bunch of other things that are really, really, really strong. Because you're going to tell a joke to the other person and they're not going to understand it. And they're going to blame you for their not understanding it. I believe that all these compatibility markers are extremely important. The most important one is to get yourself into a right relationship with yourself. And the only way you can do that is to get yourself into a right relationship with God. And the thing that really excites me lately is, I don't know if this is okay to talk about, but in John 14, when we talk about the Trinity, to getting clear about who Christ is, he is the total, Godhead made known, so that everything about the unseen God is totally available in Jesus the Christ. And then the Holy Spirit is everything. It's there to remind us of everything that Jesus is in relation to the Godhead. So I get very excited about a Christocentric theology. I think it's vitally important, but all these other things are important too.
Yeah, I think the point that Neil is making is, you know, to put it in technical terms, that a shared faith in Christ is necessary but not sufficient. I think that's right, that you can have that faith in Christ, but it still isn't, it may not be enough to hold together a relationship. But, you know, I want to say, and this gets even into more dangerous territory, I'm not always sure it's necessary. That is, you know, we hear so many testimonies of people who say, you know, my wife led me to Christ, or we had children, our children started going to Sunday school, and and I went to church and I heard the gospel. And I don't think you can plan on that. But if you ask me the simple question, can a marriage between a believer and an unbeliever, will it inevitably be a bad marriage? I would not say that. But I think at the same time, you know, we have to warn against sentimentalizing out the word that Tim uses in his book. You know, we hear so much sentimental stuff about marriage. And one sentimentalizing thing is, well, you know, maybe after we're married, I can lead that person to Christ, or maybe they'll come to faith. And I think there has to be some kind of common quest, some kind of shared goals, and even a kind of common spiritual quest. That's not a person who is just totally turned off by anything religious. I don't think that's going to work very well, you know. And you know, we do have the things in the New Testament where the believing wife sanctifies the unbelieving husband and the like. I mean, I just don't want to rule that out, but at the same time want to say that there is a real danger there that we can overlook a lot of other things. Some of the dangers, yeah. I don't know. Neil, how's that sound?
No, I think that's perfect.
Yeah. But how do you really feel about that? That's what
could I say one thing, David? I do think that there's one area where we have to do a lot of thinking, and that is attraction. Like, for instance, if you're involved with someone and you're not chemically, physically attracted to them, I always say, boy, I wouldn't try marriage without that. I would try dating, but I wouldn't try marriage. And what I mean by that is I actually think that chemical attraction isn't always present in the beginning, but I think that if it hasn't developed within 6 months, then I would wonder whether it's going to develop. I think it's very dangerous. But to go ahead as though you had it, because I think it's so important to help you get through the tough times. But the one thing that I would like for us to think about as a church sometime, not just a local church, but the kingdom of God, is how in the world do you explain attraction? I was asked to write a book on why a man falls in love with a woman. I haven't written it yet, but I've outlined it. And I came to the early conviction that a man falls in love with a woman because of what happens to him, what happens to him in her presence. And if he feels wonderfully loved in her presence, he's going to love her. He's going to be. And then I came to the conclusion that it's interesting that in all of our friendships, we want to be around the people who, when we're around them, we feel best about ourselves. The fundamental motivational construct in all of human life, in my opinion, we all are dying to feel good about ourselves. And if we get around people with whom we feel good about ourselves, we want to be around them some more. I think it's the thing that attracts us to groups like this. We feel good about ourselves in this place. We feel safe and we feel cared for and we feel treated with dignity, no matter who we are. So that this idea of chemistry, I think, can be worked on. We can build it over time.
Well, how would you respond to the other end, where a lot of times we also hear in the church, you're too picky. You have to lower your standards a bit. You know, I think oftentimes parents say that to their kids as they see their kids getting older. How would you respond to that? I mean, especially in light of all these, you know, the need to have a certain number of compatible issues and qualities. Yeah. How do you respond to
I think it's
like
a very
that?
Picky question, David. there's a truth in that, and that is we often do work with idealized conceptions of the other gender. And, you know, the one sense in which I think the one theological spiritual point that has to be made is that it's very important not to go into either a friendship or a marriage expecting that person to do what only God can do for you, you know. St. Augustine, that wonderful line at the beginning of his Confessions, you have created us for yourself, and our hearts are restless till they rest in thee. And when we turn away from the living God, we try to find that ultimate satisfaction in something other then where's the only place where you can have it? That is in a relationship with God. And so sometimes there are demands on the other that are very unrealistic. And so I think that has to be said. But I think what Neil has outlined is that there's a kind of pickiness that we do need to engage in, and that's the 27 kinds of things. I mean, when you say, well, you know, 20, well, I'm talking about our marriage, hon. That's one big difference is her sense of humor and mine. You know, that's no. I'm kidding. We're going to be married 50 years in a couple months, so that's it. But you know, when you say, well, you know, gee, Mom, I've been dating him, but you know, and we have a lot of good times together, and we go to baseball games and like, but afterward, we don't have much to talk about because we're interested in such different things. And then Mom says, oh, you're being too picky. I think there, Neil has given us a reason to think that you're not being too picky, but that there are things like that that you do need.
Yeah, I actually think that, David, that all parents ought to have to sit through a few divorces in a therapy session and see how painful it is. And I suspect that they won't push the line very much, you're being too picky. Some people maybe are too picky, but far more than people are not picky enough. To have a relationship that sustains itself over time, you need to have it pretty right.
Before I ask my last question, I want to encourage you guys to write your questions. If you have your questions written down, just raise your hand and we'll have some volunteers come around and pick up those questions. And we will also just take some questions off the floor as well, but we want to make sure we have a mix. But my final question is, dating and marriage here in the city is a really complicated issue. And what do you think that churches are doing right and or wrong when it comes to approaching this whole issue of dating and marriage?
Well, I'd like to say that I hold the church responsible for not doing as much as they might do to teach people what the crucial dimensions are. The church focuses so heavily on spiritual compatibility, and that's important. We said that. But the church doesn't focus as significantly on all these other dimensions as they need to focus. And we rely on the church to supply this kind of guidance in the most intimate areas of our lives. So I'd like to see the church take that on a little bit more, not just for a few people who come to a retreat, but for the vast numbers of people in their church. The second thing I'd like to say is that the church, as we talked about earlier today, David, the church needs to help people get ready to deal with the incredible challenge of being related to somebody else, and to teach them how to get related to themselves in a way that is really satisfying. I used to say, and I think I still kind of believe this, if you are dying to feel good about yourself and you think you can get it done in marriage in no other way, you're probably not ready to get married. And the church has to teach you how to find those great feelings about yourself apart from marriage. Otherwise, you'll put too much stress on the marriage. A man or a woman probably is not going to be able to get you to the place. I think that's what you were saying earlier. So I think the church has a real task in getting people ready for marriage.
Yeah, I think, the more general thing, David, that, you know, you and I and some of the folks here in your Faith and Work program have thought a lot about is the fact that the church has often in the past, and I don't think that's true here, but has often in the past and continues in the present to ignore whole areas of daily life. Not that the church has to be an expert on everything, but that, you know, when I was a kid, I never heard anybody ever pray for people in business. I talked to a businessman, a very wealthy, very powerful business person recently, who said, you know, I love my pastor, but he doesn't have the faintest idea what I do on a day-to-day basis. And I'm not asking that he has to have a theology of economics, but I sure wish he would think about the fact that I'm there and I struggle with things that are very different than other people. And simply the prayer life of the Christian community. I use this example with Hollywood, but we go to a large Presbyterian church that has a wonderful outreach to Hollywood. It's right on the edge of Hollywood. And one Sunday morning, and over half of the people in our congregation, very large congregation, over half of the people are involved in the entertainment industry. And one Sunday, the pastor just asked everybody involved in the entertainment industry to raise a hand. And then ask others, if you're near them, put your hands on them or reach toward them. And let's just pray for people in Hollywood this week. Now, you can't pray too specifically because some of them are camera people. And some of them are reading scripts. And some of them are acting. And some of them are producing or raising money for film. And so, but just the fact that God cares about the people in all the complexities of their lives, and the church wants to see itself as sending them out into that very important line of work. And so there's that. But then the other thing is that, and I was raised in a church, we never prayed for single people. Mm-hmm. We never prayed for people going through divorce. Or we never really prayed for families that had, couples that had just had a fight. You know, I mean, suppose you went to church and you're a married couple and you've been fighting the night before. And the pastor says, Lord, right now, I really love you. If you would just deal with marriages out there that have been experiencing extreme tension this week. And, I mean, that kind of thing. And so singleness, I think, is one of the great defects. And yet it's the basic, this is what Neil was talking about, that unless you handle your singleness, you're not going to handle your marriage very well. And a lot of the issues that we're fighting about today, same-sex, heterosexuality, and the like, the underlying issue there is how do we handle the fact that we are sexual beings and that there are many people in the Christian community who are not going to, for one reason or another, engage in intimate sexual relations? And how do we handle that? What does that mean? You know, and I just think, I think it's happening. We're talking more about it. But I think the church, if it's ever going to do the kind of work on marriage that Neil has been talking about, has to first of all concentrate on singleness.
Mm. I have one more question to ask before I turn to all your cards. No one comes to New York City to get married. I mean, they come here to work. Now, I'd love to hear from both a theological perspective as well as a psychological perspective. What's the impact of that on marriage? I mean, you see a lot of divorces, you see a lot of unhappy people. And how does work factor into the success of a marriage? And also, you know, people here theologically don't necessarily have, well, they don't have a theology of work. How does work fit into my calling as a Christian? And so, I think this is maybe something a little bit more specific to our context here, where people come in the city because they want to work.
Well, one thing is what Neil was saying earlier about the shift from a rural culture to an urban culture, so that even little towns in Kansas are more urban culture in the sense that marriage was a very different thing at the beginning of the 20th century, certainly in the 19th century, where you had the family farm, where work was shared work. And that meant that the rhythms of work and meals and leisure time, play, chores, ordinary household duties were much more integrated precisely because people were around each other a lot. They didn't have cars. It was a big thing to go into town. And we've simply changed. Now, the first thing is recognize that we don't have that anymore. The extended family isn't there for many, many people. And so the whole relationship between work and family is a very different kind of thing. And a lot of the family values stuff that we hear about is really speaking out of an earlier culture that really doesn't address the complexities of life in, say, in Manhattan or in Hoboken, you know?
I think you pointed up something really important about your church and your people and this city, and that is that you may be the most geographically dispersed people on earth. I mean, people come to New York from a lot of places, and they're away from their families, and they're away from their community that they grew up in, and all. The other thing I want to say, and so this church becomes terribly crucial. It becomes a family for a lot of these people. I think it's really very, very interesting that you have so many people out tonight for this little discussion. I didn't expect anything like this number of people. And it's an indication that people are looking for some way of thinking about their situation. But I want to say this. I've watched an awful lot of people who are pretty successful on, finding the right marriage partner. I actually think you have to take it on as a seasonal task. And by that I mean it's a season in your life when for maybe as much as 5 years you kind of look that task over. You get ready for it. For instance, on eHarmony, when you get 5 matches and then two or 3 days later you get another 5, I can tell you something. This is a terrible thing to say, but if you take too much time getting back to the people, they'll be gone. And if you just say, well, I only have 1 half hour a week to do this, yeah, it's probably not going to do it. It's just not. I would like to think, and maybe you can set us straight theologically, and I know you're a highly reformed church, and a lot of you feel, I'd like to think that God would just bring a person to us, and he put him right there. Steve Arterburn used to say that if you're waiting for somebody to ring your doorbell so that, and tell you that you're the one for them, you're most likely to marry a Jehovah's Witness. Or a paper boy.
Or the cable guy.
Cable guy. So I think it takes some real work, and I think you have to let up a little bit on your job in order to have the time to do it. It's a hard task.
And I think too, biblically, what's an enduring thing is the importance of the integrated rhythms of life. I mean, you go right to Ecclesiastes. There's a time to play. There's a time, and the whole notion these days of the whole person and. I think as individuals, we need to ask questions of, if I'm going to be a whole person, what are the things I especially have to work at? I don't have to work at doing a lot of reading or thinking. I've got to work on a lot of other things. There are certain things that I'll just do naturally and spontaneously. And I think a couple together, or friends. I mean, again, it's not just about marriage. It's about friendship. I think friends can talk about what goes into a good friendship relationship and to recognize the rhythms of life and the need to just hang out together and experience that leisure time, that wasted time together, which also has a productive point.
Well, for a group that had 0% interest in dating, we do have a lot of questions here. So I'd like to actually kind of specify the format into a lightning round here. I'd like to get through as many of these as possible. So if you could try to succinctly answer these very simple questions, that would be greatly appreciated so we can get through these questions. The first question, what kind of questions should we be asking ourselves to see if we're ready for marriage? 30 seconds.
And you want this to be succinct, one or two words.
I think you ask yourself, I wrote a book once called Finding Contentment. And I tried to put the questions in that I think that would give you a sense of how content you are. And honestly, I think that one of the things that you need to figure out for yourself is how contented you are. Because if you're not contented, I don't think you're ready for marriage. You've got to come at it out of a place of internal calm. And if you don't have that, then I would think that you've got some other work to do in some of the areas that we've talked about earlier tonight.
I think the distinction between the initial basis for attraction and that which sustains a relationship. It's true of our relationship to God. Nothing wrong with somebody who comes to Jesus because they're afraid they might go to hell. But if 20 years later, that's the only reason they're sticking with Jesus, that's not a very mature relationship. We need to think about, I think the important question to ask is, what am I going to be wanting from a life partner 20 years from now? That's a very important question. And that can really be input into the quest for the relationship.
Great. I'm going to rephrase this question. We hear sometimes that you're marrying a stone that it will over time be chiseled into someone. How do you wait until you start to see a bit more of the sculpture, or do you, especially in light of all these issues of compatibility, how would you answer that question?
Well, frankly, I think that is really a profound question. And I would like to say that I think you have to be balanced in recognizing that when you're first married, it's very different in terms of your expectations and the possibilities. It's very different than it's going to be a little later on. You grow in marriage, and you develop a deeper and deeper understanding of one another. Marriage is all about unselfishness. And it takes a while for unselfishness to become unselfishness. You know, you don't just automatically. Unselfishness doesn't happen because you say, you know, marriage is about unselfishness. It happens over time where you're plagued by the need to be selfish. And you make a decision. I'm going to change that somehow. So I think when you start out, you have to realize that there is a lot of room for you to develop a lot of new strengths if you'll take your time. On the other hand, there are certain things that you better have early on. Like, for instance, one of the things, I say that there are three major things that you look for. First of all, wait to get married until you're healthy. That's one thing you look for. And make sure that you marry somebody who's healthy. And there are certain obvious things. I mean, if they lie to you, they're not healthy. The second thing is find somebody to love who's a lot like you. And what we mean by that is similarities are wonderfully encouraging of a marriage. You find somebody who completes your sentences for you. And just the way you want it, you kind of look at them and you say, wow, you know, you and I have something really deep. And then the third thing I think that you look for is over time with this person, do I want to be with them more or less? But when I say over time, I mean, make sure you spend enough time with them so that you start getting a feeling of, wow, this person wears well. That's what you're talking about, I think, is trying to get to the place where you wear well.
Yeah. A good sculpture happens for at least three reasons. One is that you got some stuff to work with. Secondly, you've got a picture of what you want to do with that stuff. And then thirdly, you have a realistic expectation that the tools and the skills are available to go from the formless stuff to the finished product. You got to be pretty sure that you're not idealizing or romanticizing or, unrealistic expectations. And that's why I think counseling and various kinds of things are necessary to see whether you really have it in that relationship. You have the capacity to go from the block of whatever it is to the person that you wish that person would be.
What's your theory or statistic why so many of us are single and don't want to date or get married?
Well, I'll tell you what I've always thought, and Richard will tell you what he has always thought, and then we'll tell you why that's probably inadequate. But I've always thought that we were heading for exactly what we're into now. For the last 30 years, I've thought we had. When you saw the divorce rate go up in the United States by 300%, that didn't happen to families that didn't exist. I mean, that happened to real families. And some of them were yours. I mean, if we wanted to tonight, if we wanted to take the time to say, how many of you have experienced divorce in the home of your origin, your family origin? How many of you have sisters or brothers who have gone through divorce? And I promise you that some of you, your families have been riddled with divorce. It's horribly painful. And so right now you're so wary that you think to yourself, it's too risky perhaps for me to put my heart out there on the line with the likelihood that I'm going to have to go through this. There has been more pain in America in the last 50 years, more pain in America from broken marriage relationships and from any other source. I don't think there's any question about it. When you have a situation today, I forgot to tell you this one statistic, I believe this. 75% of all marriages turn out to be disappointing. We know that about 40 to 45% of all marriages end in divorce. Another 6 or 8% end in separation, but the two people don't get a divorce. Of the other half of the marriages, about half of those marriages have one or both persons saying, I'm not very satisfied in this relationship. So upwards of 75% of the people probably would not get married again. Wow. I mean, and those people are all around you. Some of those people are your mom and dad. Some of those people are you. And when you've had that much pain, why wouldn't you be wary? Why wouldn't you be saying, I don't know if I want to get married again?
Yeah, just very quickly, I think another factor, and I agree wholeheartedly with Neil, but another factor is simply that we have a lot of substitutes for friendships, including what we call friending. The internet and other things have made substitutes for relationships that in our culture, our subculture, the culture of Manhattan, the culture of New York City, the East, urban culture, you may have a genuine loneliness, but there are a lot of ways in which you can try to fill that, and some of it at least works for a while, you know.
How would you address the demographic reality of New York City, or specifically Manhattan? This person is quoting Richard Florida, saying 350,000 more women than men in Manhattan. On top of that, if you're a Christian woman looking for a Christian man, I'm sure that number is even lower. How would you speak to the women in this group about some of these statistics?
Move to China.
That's pretty good. I think that is one of the devastating sociological phenomena of this day, and that is that, you know, now they're telling us that for every 100 men who graduate from college, 135 women are graduating from college. I don't fully understand exactly what's happening in this situation, why men are pretty discouraged in our culture. And women are getting frustrated with the inability to find somebody who's the right person for them. It's happening all over America, I promise you. And so I think that one of the things that I would encourage you women is to relax some of your boundaries. You know what I mean by that, I hope. I would not have you relax your standards. I'd have you relax some of your boundaries. Like, for instance, I asked somebody, I told David this earlier, that I asked somebody in Los Angeles one day, a woman, where would you go to find love? If you could find real love that would last a lifetime, where would you go? She said, anywhere on earth. I've asked men in West Los Angeles, where would you go? He said, well, not as far as the east side of Los Angeles. And I know there are people in Manhattan who wouldn't go to New Jersey. But I would encourage you to think about that possibility that you might have to relax some of your boundaries.
Just don't go to Utah, okay? That's...
So, if you could, Neil, put your aside the fact that you're the founder of the largest and most successful online matching site, at what point do people start using online dating? Is there a sequence? Meaning, do you look around your geographic and your church pool first? And, you know, when that's exhausted, is that when you now turn to the internet and some of these online sites? Or would you recommend just going on one of these online sites because in some ways that's even better than looking around, you know, your neighborhood?
Well, I got to tell you, you think that you have it bad in New York City because there's, I guess, such a large discrepancy between the number of men and the number of women. But I got to tell you, in Western Massachusetts, there are hardly any singles. And you find situations in various states where there are hardly any people for you to be around who are in the same marital status category that you're in. So there are those problems. When do you look to the greatest salesmen for eHarmony are the people who've gotten married on our site. They tell the world, this is wonderful. Now, the people who don't get satisfaction on our site don't usually talk about it too much because they're a little fearful that, you know, that might have something to do with them and they don't want to advertise that. But we have thought, we're tired of advertising on television. It's worn us out. And I know you're saying, well, we're tired of seeing your advertising. Can I tell you this personal thing? If we don't advertise for 2 days on television, do you know what happens to the number of applicants we get? It goes boom, like that. We think to ourselves, Jiminy, you know, we put millions and millions of ads on television everywhere in the United States. Wouldn't you think that it would carry just for a week? But the soon as we stop advertising, boom, the number of people. It's almost like I want to say to those people, where have you been? I mean, when they come in and register for eHarmony, I want to say, how come now? And isn't that your question? Why do they go then? I don't know. I think it has something to do. Timing has a lot to do with life. And what you've gone through maybe has a lot to do.
Do you have statistics on how effective ads with you in them are?
That's sort of a personal question. I don't think I'd want you to know. No, you know, for a long time, we had five things that we used in our ads. We had the couples. And you remember, we've always had, maybe you remember, we've always had three or four couples, or we used to always have that. We had Natalie Cole singing that wonderful song of hers. And people would tell us, you know, when I hear that song, I know it's your ad. And then we had an avuncular. This is what people most often call me, is avuncular. That means an old uncle. And I think that they got a little bit of trust out of me. I mean, they got some feeling of trust. He has to be trustworthy. Otherwise, why would they put him on there? And then they liked the free offer that we gave. The free offer is a very interesting offer, and that is to get your own personality profile. And those personality profiles were really pretty good. And we found that people developed a trust in us because we read them pretty well. I forget now, Marilyn, what the fifth thing was, but those ads for a long time carried us. I'm going to tell it to you straight tonight. We sold a part of our company. I never wanted to do that. It was a mission, but we sold a part of our company, about 30% of our company. And when we did that, we got a little focused on something other than our basic mission. And I'm very sad about that. I feel really repentant about that. I think we're trying to be in the process again of gathering it back. Marilyn and I went into this totally as a mission. I was an old man when we started eHarmony. I was 65. And when Marilyn told me that two people were going to get married on our site, I said, what? I couldn't believe it. We went down to see them in Texas. We wanted to say, what, tell us about this. The guy was from Eugene, Oregon. She was from San Antonio, Texas. She said to him, where are you contacting me? I said I wanted somebody within 30 miles of my house. He said, if it works out the way I think it's going to work out, I'll be 30 miles from your house. And so he did. He moved down there. We had no idea that we would ever get to the place where we'd have 100,000 marriages in a year. This is all God's plan. Of course, I believe that God cares about marriage enormously. I think it's at the center of the nurturing life of our country. So we wish so much that this could work for vast numbers of people. And if it could, I believe God will have a smile on his face. I think he cares deeply about whether or not you get what you need and want in the way of marriage.
Okay, here's a tough question. I see men who place so much on looks or the woman being, quote, hot and not getting beyond that. Comment? That's verbatim.
Well, there's no question that men are much more visual. You remember some of you might remember, when we started eHarmony, we didn't allow pictures. We wanted people to really get a sense of what was going on inside the other person. And we got into a perilous place where men literally wouldn't come on eHarmony because they were afraid that they were going to get all tied in with a woman who then would disappoint them deeply. And so they started saying, you don't allow pictures on your site, we're not coming on your site. So then we turned our strategy a little bit and we said, okay, you can have your picture on there if you choose to have your picture on there. But not, we don't want you to put it on there. We know what you know, and that is that if you get all involved with the outside of another person, that doesn't have much durability. You get involved with the other person's heart and soul. That has durability over time. We wish we could get people focused on that. Can I tell you very quickly something that really interests me? On a 10-point scale, if right now you think you need somebody who on attractiveness is, let's say, a 6 on a 10-point scale, if I can get you to get to know that person on the inside of them, you'll go down somewhere right around 3/4 of a point. In other words, you thought you needed a 6. All of a sudden, you'll move down to close to a 5. So you'll see the other person for who they are. They're not as attractive as maybe you wish that they were, but you know them on the inside. You know their heart. And now you will give them you'll give them more slack on the way they look to you. I think that's important.
Yeah, just quickly, that I think obviously physical attraction is a relevant factor, and it always has been. And there are different cultures of physical attraction as well. I think the danger today is the increasing commodification of looks, where, you know, there's so many ways, and we don't need to go into them here, but so many ways in which we've reduced people to surface. And that I think we really need to get into, quite apart from even some of the issues we're talking about here, and that is just the how we view people and what purposes we see them as serving in our lives. And I think we've become a very reductionistic people, and in a reductionistic culture, you're going to have people who look for reduced people. And I think that's a shame.
Yeah.
Okay, what I want to do is actually open up the questions to the floor. Okay, so Richard here. I think I can hear you, okay. And then I'll...
Just for Neil especially, if he's given such a long
Yeah.
Yeah, how did you get to be where you are in your marriage?
Yeah.
Much more eloquently said, but just to summarize.
David's trying to teach us how to be succinct. I believe that most of the time you pursue other people pretty much on the basis of unconscious motivation. In other words, you will look at for something in another person. You will not know you're looking for it. I told you, I couldn't believe when I went back and looked at the four women I dated, and they were all intelligent. I was obviously really looking for a high level of intelligence. I'll tell you another interesting thing. I grew up in a church called the Church of Christ, and it's the largest denomination in Tennessee. And it just happened that my parents in Iowa had gotten involved with some person who had really encouraged them to think about that church, and they had. And it's a good church in many, many ways. But I grew up in that church, and that church took the position you should marry somebody in the Church of Christ. I never dated anyone in the Church of Christ. And I looked back and I said, wow, that's interesting. I never dated any. I wasn't aware of that. So the unconscious motivation. Now, that's where a lot of the community aspects of your life come in. And I think I began to see in Marilyn somebody that really satisfied me at a deep level. And I wasn't conscious of what the factors were that were important to me. I like somebody who has class. I'm really looking for class. I don't know what that means to me, but I like the way... I like the way she dressed. I like her. I liked her hygiene. I like the way she smelled. That's okay, isn't it? I mean, when I was around her, I liked her choice of clothing. But you know what I liked the most about Marilyn? She'd moved 17 times when she was growing up. She was here from here, and she was always the new girl in school. And so she kind of had to find herself in the middle of all that. And then she came to Pepperdine University. And by the way, if you go to the same school with the person you marry, the divorce rate drops to under 10%. I don't know exactly what that is. You can think about that. But finding somebody to marry who went through a lot of the same experiences you did. So she came to Pepperdine, and she had gone through all those 17 moves, and she then got voted the most outstanding student at Pepperdine. I love that. I love that. I mean, because somebody really took a hold of their life, and they fought to get their life straightened out. I love that in somebody. And those are the people I cry about on the athletic fields when the guy says, you know, my grandma raised me, and I owe everything to my grandma. I love that. I'm a sentimentalist. I get inspired by that kind of thing. So I think that Marilyn and I did a pretty good job of, first of all, we were extremely fortunate. I don't like lucky, but we were extremely fortunate. But then secondly, I think we had some of the right unconscious things that we were looking for in each other. And that comes, I suppose, from thinking a whole lot. I went back and looked at my 11th grade paper that I turned in about why two people should marry each other. 11th grade! So I was always thinking about that.
Okay. Other questions? Yep. Can you stand up? And you're going to have to speak very loudly. Yeah, how much initiative should women take in this pursuit of marriage? Is that right?
I don't think that's quite it.
I'm asking on a more proactive sense of what you...
Yes, for example, like,
Gotcha. They were just living their life, and it kind of came upon them. Yeah, and so is that like the default? Is that how women should think about this? Should women, in terms of the attitude that they should have, should they just be doing their work, trying to be faithful day in and day out, working in their jobs, and just kind of wait upon the Lord to bring the right person? And then the other question is, well, it's maybe the other side of the coin. Should women take active initiative in pursuing romantic interests?
Just that, you cited scripture, and there are lots of cases of that, but there are some counterexamples too. I mean, Ruth, sort of putting herself in a place where she gets to meet, So I'm not sure. I'm not sure that we can just go on those. I mean, that's indicative of a very different cultural situation, I think. Well, at the same time, there are, one could argue that. I do think we just basically go about our calling, and we try to find people who can support us and partner with us and complement our lives in the callings that we have. And so I do think it's important to concentrate on our daily work and hope that the relationships that we build will somehow nurture and allow us to form those kinds of relationships.
I take a strong stand that women need to be assertive in pushing for what they want. And I've seen hundreds, I've seen thousands of women. We now think we've had about 700,000 marriages. I've seen a lot of those marriages, the result of women being very assertive. I would like to encourage women to think about being assertive in a very feminine way. And I don't think in a very feminine way rules out at all the possibility of getting on a site and looking for the kind of person that you're looking for and making it clear that you're interested in dating a certain person, that kind of thing. I don't see that as not feminine. I see it as smart and wise, and you're the ones who are going to get the persons who are right for you. So women are smarter than men on this, and you read human relationships, interactions, better than men do, and it would be an absolute sad day for America if women started backing away from the task of doing the pairing in a wonderful way.
Other questions? Okay, let's go one there, and I think we're running out of time.
Yeah. So how come we can hear from some parts of the room better than we can from other parts? I heard that one. Do we have some suggestions on how we can be more flexible in terms of what we're looking to find and all that? Well, I would go down across. And by the way, if you leave me your email address and you don't have the 29, I'll send those to you. Those 29 variables, but I would say that you go down through each one of those with one or two persons who know you well, and get them to talk with you about whether that's something you really need or just something, and try to whittle it down to what will be wonderful for you, but it won't be something that's superfluous to your life, and see if you can't make your list a little more succinct. And then what I say to people all the time is, find the four or five things that are just absolutely crucial that you can weed people out very quickly on. And then find the five things that you can get off your list pretty fast. It's just not crucial to you. Maybe you don't need somebody who has a sense of humor. You know, you've got
enough
of it.
Watch Jon Stewart, you know, just watch TV, yeah? Watch Jon Stewart.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, you know, his book, Finding the Love of Your Life? Yeah. I think that's and all proceeds from here on will go to Fuller Seminary.
That's true.
That's really a solid piece of work. I mean, in one sense, an easy read, but it's a very wise book, Finding the Love of Your Life. And I think the 29 are in that book, aren't they?
No, they're not in that book, but they're in a book called Date or Soulmate.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But I want to tell you that a lot of my books are, we bought them out from eHarmony. But if you want them and you write me, we probably send them to you. We want to be careful of what we say in a time like this, but if we can be helpful to you, I promise you, this is a mission for us. Nothing would satisfy me more than out of this night, 10 people would find the love of their life because we had this talk. It'd be the most exciting thing in the world for me. So if I can be helpful to you that way, let me know.
I just want to add that I think the things that Neil has talked about and the 29... To have people talking about this is an important thing. I mean, I think that was a very wise piece of advice. You know, look at those 29 things, get together with some friends and just say, how do you see these things in terms of who I am and how you view what would be a good partner for me, a good mate for me? And I just think that's very wise. But to start with, and this is one of our complaints about the church, is that the church really isn't working on this stuff. And, I've got to tell you the one horror story that you've heard from me. But, when Neil talks to some pastors and says, you really got to think about this. And they say that the response is sometimes, well, we can't really get into that because by the time they come to us, they already have hired the caterer, Well, I mean, if marriage is going to go to hell because of catering, we're in big trouble. And it isn't, even premarital counseling isn't the issue. It's the prior questions. And for a generation like that's represented here to take those things and sit around and talk about them and to kind of create a culture of discernment that's based on some solid and Christian-inspired research, I think can be a wonderful game changer in this whole business of dating in New York City. Yeah.
I think that's it. So can you join me? It's been such a great privilege for us to be able to sit here with these two gentlemen. So thank you so much.